Dave Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
Yeah. Ce soir-là de 1944, Montréal a défait Détroit 9-1. Maurice Richard marqua 8 points, 5 buts et 3 passes. Une légende est née.
Come on. I believe that it's meant to be, and it is a little like 93. With waving hands, we hold it high and raise number 25 to the sky. I believe it right in the mix, and it is a little like 86. With waving hands, we hold it high and raise number 25 to the sky.
Yeah. Here's a rap from the cradle of organized sports, where we come together for a common cause. I remember number 24, cheers busting out every house, every home. Hard to believe it's so long ago, and I know we got a long, long way to go. I believe this city's got a chance to cop it, so I bust my Camilleri shirt and rock it. Spoke to the ghost of the rocket, told me once the wheels are in motion, can't stop it. Yeah, I thought back to that 10-minute old, when his teardrops pressed the bell sent to fall.
When I got home, I could hardly speak, so we will be taking a break for about 10 minutes, and then we'll come back and do the other bit. About neurotransmitters. So that's tonight's plan. So the first one here I've entitled Neural Communication. Basically, if this would start, there we go. Early on, it was pretty clear that electricity, played a role in neural communication. It was pretty obvious. And this was from a whole bunch of different researchers figuring this out. Galvani, you ever heard of galvanic skin response? That's the change in conductance of skin when you sweat. It's what's measured in one of the things measured in a polygraph. Galvani, who was Italian, did a really interesting experiment. So he's got these frog legs, and he's not good. Maybe he ate them after because they are tasty. Yeah, they taste like chicken. That with a kind of a fishy overtone, but frog's legs are actually good. Except they look like legs, like they look a lot like human legs. But anyway, this is a really weird experiment. So he's got like a little kind of lightning rod. Because you got to remember, it's the mid-1800s, so it's not like there's plugs in walls for electricity. Everybody knows that lightning is electricity. People know that. But it's not like there's a power grid. You got to realize there's no power grid till the 1900s. So what Galvani does is, where can I get electricity? Well, the sky. I'll wait till it's stormy out, and I'll hook frog legs up to... this is serious. This is what he did. To a lightning rod. As you do. It sounds very mad scientist, doesn't it? Right? It really does. So he does this, and he's got... electrodes, pretty primitive, but they're still electrodes, in the muscles. Lightning strikes, frog legs move. That's a pretty cool experiment. That's actually very clever, isn't it? I mean, when you think about it, how are you going to get electricity? Well, lightning. Hook it up. So he gets, yeah.
He didn't fry it?
Well, no, because he's just running the current down, okay? Not the heat, right? So... and if I'm not mistaken, he had some, I wouldn't call it a resistor, but he stepped it down. You know, it's not like he had a transformer of some sort, but yeah. Because if he had that, he probably would have had his own power grid, right? But yeah, it's he's getting electricity, basically collecting it and zapping it, and he's collecting it from lightning, which is awesome. So this is one of the first demonstrations that electricity is important in nervous transmission. Fritsche Hitzig, a couple of Germans, stimulated the cortex of various animals, and they got twitches in the animals. So that we're talking here about dogs and cats mostly. What they do is they cut into the skull and remove part of the skull. And then they'd take electrodes and from a battery pass electricity onto the cortex, and they'd see different parts of the bodies move. This is a little bit later here. And now we've got a little bit of battery technology here so they can store up the... Excuse me, they can store up the power. They don't have to actually have it hooked up to lightning. Again, it looks like it's causing movement. An MD, John Bartholow, I think it's John, from Cleveland or Columbus or Cincinnati, some big city in Ohio. I think it's Cleveland. He's a neurologist, and he's got a patient, Mary Rafferty. And poor Mary Rafferty, she's got bone cancer on her skull. And how do they deal with that? It's different than we would today. Today we'd use radiation and chemo, and we'd probably do our best to get rid of it that way. Back then, you just remove it. So they just take the whole thing out. So now she's got about the size of a toonie hole in her head. So she's got exposed brain. Now, this doesn't bode well for your life in general, but it really doesn't bode well when your doctor says, here's an opportunity for me to do some research. So what Bartholow does is he places electrodes on her cortex. It's so weird, you know? And he gets movement when, of course, the cortex is stimulated. So he gets things like, first of all, he gets movement because he's giving power to motor areas. And then he also gets some sensation stuff. I feel like something's touching me here, touching me there, etc. This is unethical on levels that I can't even begin to imagine. And it was even, you might think, okay, yeah. This is, oh, they cut animals' heads open, and you couldn't do that today easily, though you could get it past the animal ethics board, perhaps, if it's the only way to do it. This you wouldn't pass today, but you sort of think, well, we can't be completely moralistic. It's the late 1800s. It was an ethical scandal then. People thought this was ridiculous. He got in, there were ethics investigations by the American Medical Association. He ended up, however, becoming the dean of the medical school, like Johns Hopkins. I think it was Johns Hopkins. So, I mean, it's weird that he actually ended up doing okay, but people were outraged. And in fact, one of his little experiments led to Mary going into a coma. She was in the coma for 3 days. She eventually woke up and then shortly thereafter died. Now, was her prognosis good to begin with? No, clearly not. She had an exposed brain. You know, it's not something you could easily deal with then or even probably now. Nonetheless, not the most dignified thing to do to somebody. So those of you that want to go to medical school, if somebody comes like, don't do that to them, okay? Don't zap their brains with electricity. It's not nice. Now, of course, you ever seen the Heritage Moment? You know those Heritage Moments they have on TV? Teach us our own history because we don't learn it. No, that's why, I think. Or it's taught poorly, maybe. I don't know. Well, Wilder Penfield worked at the Montreal Neurological Institute. He was a neurologist, neurosurgeon, an amazing neurologist. One of the guys that worked with Brenda Milner and Donald Hebb, basically, he was the practical guy, and Hebb and Milner were the theoretical people founding cognitive neuroscience. So this is, you know, an important guy. The psychology building at McGill is called the Hebb Building, and it's on Rue Dr. Penfield. Like, it's on Dr. Penfield Street. And so is the Montreal Neurological Institute. Important guy. So in the Heritage Moment, you may have seen, woman has a seizure. And every time she has a seizure, she smells burnt toast just before she has a seizure. Now, this should tell you something. If you have a sort of sensory experience or movement, beginning of a seizure, that's probably where the seizure's originating in your brain. Now, we still, to this day, wouldn't know where the burnt toast smell would be stored in your brain, and it would probably be a little bit different for everybody anyway. But every time she would have a seizure, she would smell burnt toast. Now, today, what do we do when someone has a seizure, just one? Well, we try to force them to have another one. If they don't, it's like, well, it's perhaps a one-time thing. But if you have more than one, they try to induce seizures, keep you awake all night, don't feed you, give you quickly flickering lights, things like that, to try to get you to seize. Because if they can get you to seize, they can use EEGs to pretty much roughly locate where it is, and then maybe they do something like an MRI to see if there's some part of your brain that's not working properly. Back then, there's no EEGs, and there's no MRIs, for sure. So what would happen would be, this is what Penfield, this was his technique. he would take someone into the operating room and he'd have them awake and he'd take their skull off. Now, you're awake because, in fact, your brain, and this is one of the things, in fact, that Barthelot found, Mary Rafferty felt no sensation on her brain. It's funny, it's full of nerves, but they aren't sensory neurons, so you actually don't feel anything if you touch a brain. And, in fact, a lot of brain surgery to this day is done while you are awake. A long surgery like Penfield was doing there, well, he wouldn't be awake nowadays. Of course, you wouldn't have to do this kind of surgery. But shorter surgeries, an hour or under, they're done with you awake. You're doped up at a level that's unreal. But you're awake. Because they'd rather not put you to sleep ever for an operation. The other thing is they can tell very quickly if they've hit the wrong place. If, you know, your arm starts to move, let's say, for example. Or you panic or something like that, right? You're bolted down, like you're in a halo thing held in. When my dad had his biopsy on his brain, about 2 years ago, right around now, well, closer to January, he was awake. They literally used a drill and drilled a hole in the side of his head while he was awake. Now, he was doped up. And he had a local anesthetic, of course, and he was doped up like crazy because that night he called me and I said, how'd it go? And he says, it was pretty well. I've had a martinis. I said, you've had a lot of morphine and probably some benzodiazepine diet. It's actually like having about 12 martinis. Enjoy the ride, dude. Because most people aren't allowed to do this legally. But in this case, she would get a local, the character in the Heritage Moment, they take off the skull, and she sits there and he stimulates until, and of course in the Heritage Moment, Dr. Penfield, I smell burnt toast! Some of you have seen that and recognize my impression, thank you. And then it's like, oh, that's where it is, you go in, you remove it. Right? Because you don't want to do exploratory brain surgery, just start messing around in there. It's an important piece of gear. So this is what, and then when Penfield was doing this, one of the things that he found was when he would stimulate with all these patients, and he was doing this clinically, he was mapping the brain. Because he'd be like, oh, this part does this, this part does this. And he was getting movement, he was getting sensation, even sometimes memories. Sometimes. Not played up, not as much as it's made out to be in a lot of introductory psych textbooks. But there were cases of people remembering, you know, their fifth birthday party all of a sudden, things like that. So, again, now this is the early part of the 1900s.
Would that also explain when people have, what's it called, an aurora? A aura seizure? There's different people that have exposures before a seizure.
So, like, the aura around, like, everything getting all kind of foggy kind of thing. It could, yeah. It would depend on where in the brain you were getting the seizure.
Because pick people up with ambulance. I mean, we used to get that a lot of the times. Like they'd come out of it, they'd be in a merge, our next call or whatever.
Yeah.
They would be talking about
it. Yeah.
Not everyone.
No.
But some people.
A lot of your brain.
Your first time.
A good fifth of your brain's doing vision. So you might have some problem there. I mean, that wouldn't be surprising. Yeah. Yeah. Good question. So this is, he's mapping the brain. He's also trying to help people, but he's mapping the brain. You had a couple of people like Caton and Helmholtz. Helmholtz, you might recognize the name from Color Vision, if you took Sensation Perception, or even Intro Psych, you might recognize that name. What these guys did was they developed instrumentation to measure electrical, among other things, to measure the electrical activity of a single neuron. And Hodgkin, whose name is lent to Hodgkin's disease, same guy, and Huxley, who is one of the many famous Huxleys that did everything from hang out with Charles Darwin to write The Brave New World. It's a pretty rich family of, rich in money, but also rich in intellectualism, got giant axons from giant squid. And these are big mother axons. You can see these without a microscope. And what they did, using things like an oscilloscope, which is something that Helmholtz invented, they were able to see the electrical activity. And you've got to understand, this electrical activity happens very quickly. It's on the order of milliseconds when a cell fires, okay? So one of the things that Hodgkin and Huxley did is they had a series of differential equations, which I'm not going to put on the board because most of us don't do calculus, and frankly, I don't remember them. So I could make some differential equations up, but why would I do that? And they figured out what the resting potential of a neuron was. Yeah, so it's very neat research. And it's, of course, negative 70 millivolts. Yeah, because we do it today and we get the same number. So they're probably right. And it's negative 70 millivolts in you and me and a squid and a nematode. Like, that's how neurons work, which is great. I mean, it's the same thing that, you know...
What about
bird? Yeah. Can't it be higher? No, it's the same. Yep. Yeah, same neurotransmitters, roughly. I mean, there are some that might be different, but yeah, it's the first thing with a nervous system would probably be something like a little flatworm, like a little nematode, and that's a pretty successful thing, so there's no way that it's going to be changed. It works, you know? But yeah, the resting and action potentials are the same in everything, which is cool. Just like blood is blood is blood. It carries iron. No, sorry, what am I saying? It carries oxygen. It's iron that turns rusty, which is carries iron. Yeah, that's what your body runs on iron. Most people don't know that. It carries iron. Yeah, hemoglobin is... Yeah. Anyway. Except in Vulcans on Star Trek, and their hemoglobin is based on copper. That's why Mr. Spock has green blood. See? These are the things you learn. Yes, I'm the kind of the person that gets books about the backstory to Star Trek. Okay, neurons have a resting potential. I'm sure you've gone over this. You would have gone over this in intro psych. And that's about negative 70 millivolts. So when they're not firing, they're still doing something. They're at negative 70. What they do is they selectively allow certain ions in. And ions, right? So an ion is when an atom either takes on or gives up an electron. So you get, for example, something like sodium, right? It'll give up an electron, so it has one more proton than it has electrons, and now it's a positive ion. Because it's got a charge now of a charge of one, right? One more positive than negative. Sometimes chlorine will take on an extra electron, and you get a Cl negative. Another important one here, potassium, will give up an electron.
So these elements can always be positive or negative?
No, they can only, depending on where they are in the periodic table, if they're on the left side of the periodic table, they will only ever give up an electron. If they're on the right side, they will only ever take on an electron. There's weird things that can happen, like you can get... These aren't really in the nervous system, but like you can actually make an ion out of xenon, which isn't supposed to happen, right? And that's why they call it noble gases now, not inert gases. But, I mean, you have to force it to do that naturally. And that's why when you get sodium chloride salt, it's sodium ions and chlorine ions together with a really weak bond between the two. Same thing with sodium monosodium glutamate. It's a glutamate molecule which has taken on an electron and a sodium that's given one up, and there's a really weak bond between the two. Yep. But it depends where it is in the periodic table. They either do one or the other. So what happens here is that selectively certain ions are allowed in to the neuron, and others are kept out. With stimulation, sodium's allowed in, and sodium is a positive ion. Sodium ions are allowed in. And I'll talk a bit about how that works later on. So that's the resting potential. See, so it's actually doing something while it's at rest. Your nervous system is always working. An action potential happens when a lot of sodium is allowed in, and then you get changes in the difference between the difference in concentration of the positive ions inside and outside the neuron changes at one place on the neuron, and then it changes at the next place. It kind of cascades down. And I've talked about this the other day, right? So you're constantly, you being a neuron, are trying to keep yourself here, negative. More positives outside than in, right? However, if sodium's allowed in with stimulation, you try to get rid of it. You're hooked up that way, no matter what you are, right? Problem is, if there's so much sodium coming in, the system that keeps the resting potential collapses, and this negative charge collapses. It depolarizes, it goes from negative 70, and it zooms often to like positive 55. So it's chemical to electrical, and I think that's cool. I just think it's cool. Okay. So what there is in your nervous system is there are these chemical pumps. Okay? This is inside the neuron. This is outside the neuron. Here's the plasma membrane. Okay, so there's the membrane of the cell. What's happening here is, you see there's the sodium ions, and these are potassium ions. So you would actually think, it's sort of intuitively, that in fact there'd be negative ions inside and positive outside, and that's actually not how it works. It's that there are more positives outside than inside. And this is called active transport. So you can see this is going to take energy. The question that people have asked for years is, why would it be like this? It seems odd. Why wouldn't you just have off and on? You think about lights. You know, off, on. Light goes off, light goes on. Little Simpsons reference for you. Does it make encoding things easier? Is it easier to, you know, I don't really know if I buy that. Does it make reactions faster? That I think I buy. Instead, think of this like an analogy. If you're drawing a bow, right now the bow is off. It's not firing, but it's ready. Right? If I let go, the arrow goes pretty quickly. If I'm here and I just push the arrow, it goes pretty slowly. So, I mean, it's that kind of like that analogy. So it might make the reaction times a little faster. An action potential happens when stimulation causes the sodium-potassium pump to stop. Sodium now gets in, and the potassium goes out. That's basically what happens. Okay? And you can see that a cell that's doing this is taking up a great deal of energy. Right? Questions so far? You good? All right. Sort of reverse later. The pumps are turned back on. Everything's pumped out. And now the cell's ready to fire again. So, well, let's bring both these up. We can talk about information being integrated because that's what your nervous system is doing, right? For the most part, yeah, I know, it's making you move and it's also feeling and seeing and touching and all that great stuff and hearing. But mostly it's integrating information. So if we have I should start remembering to bring the chalk and the brush behind there, and I wouldn't have to look like an idiot. Well, sorry, more like an idiot. So if you've got, for example, here's a couple of axons, some dendrites here, okay? Some dendritic spines. Maybe this one on the right, maybe what this one's doing is it's actually an inhibitory synapse, okay? So how do inhibitory synapses work? Well, actually, what they do is they let chlorine in, okay? That makes it more negative. Now, again, the neuron's going to try to get rid of that, too. It wants to be at negative 70. So if chlorine ions get in, It wants to push them out, get them back to negative 70. And there's a whole other active transport mechanism that takes care of that. Over here, we've got some stimulation going on. We're now getting some sodium coming in. Okay, we're getting a couple of sodium ions are coming in. Here we have what's called an inhibitory postsynaptic potential. Here we have an excitatory postsynaptic potential. Okay? The neuron isn't firing yet. The neuron hasn't fired yet. It's not made that decision yet. Okay? But we can talk about postsynaptic potentials, that it's excitatory here and inhibitory here. Okay? Does that make some sense? So that's an excitatory postsynaptic potential is when you start to get more of a positive or less of a negative charge. An inhibitory postsynaptic potential is when you get less of a more negative charge. Okay? And typically what happens, if it was really just like this, this would just all end up going back to zero. No, sorry, back to negative 70. Because it's not going to be enough. It's not going to be enough. So you're going to get, what you want to get, and I talked about this the other day, is both temporal and spatial summation. So we've got, let's put another dendritic spine in this neuron. Put one here. And we'll have another one here. And we'll make this another sodium one just to make it easy. So some sodium's getting in. Okay. That doesn't say net, it says Na positive. Okay. So eventually what's going to happen here, let's say this happens early. And a couple of this is only a few milliseconds. A few milliseconds later, these two go. You're now more likely, so you get a excitatory postsynaptic potential. Excitatory postsynaptic potential here. And then, say, 5 milliseconds later, an inhibitory postsynaptic potential there, in the middle. What's going to happen, so now this is going to be a really ugly looking neuron. Okay? You know, that doesn't even look like a moose head anymore. I don't know. Kind of looks like one of them hand turkeys that kids make and bring you home, you know, around Thanksgiving. It kind of looks like that, doesn't it? You can tell who the parents are in the room, by the way, because we've all had those brought home to us. And we all made them in school. You always forget the stupid crafts you made in school till your kid brings you home one of them stupid crafts. And you go, I made this shit too, and my parents had to go, oh great, this is awesome. Yeah. They're cool for a while, then it gets old. You know, let's admit it. So, what's going to happen here is, if this one's a little later than these two, right? Perhaps now the charge is now collapsing all the way down here. And then the reason I brought this in here is because there's your axon hillock. Right? And remember I said, that's where that decision's made. That's where the decision's made to fire or not. The whole time, the rest of this neuron's trying to keep everything in negative 70. Trying. And then it just gives up. Because the sodium-potassium pump can't keep up. Right? It's like it's raining so heavily that you may as well turn your sump pump off because your stuff's going to get wrecked. May as well just do that and say, bring on the insurance. Best $40 you can spend is sewer backup and sump pump backup insurance. I'm just telling you that right now. Because if you've never watched your own dryer float by, because I've seen that, and we got all new stuff. Got this far from the electrical panel. I was watching it. My wife said, what do? I said, pack a bag and run. The house is about to explode. And then I heard the greatest sound in the world. When the ice jam broke. And I went, and I called the insurance company and everything was good. Thank you. I used to think insurance companies were all weasels. Now I love them. So, the hell was I? Right, so we've got these two happening at the same time. If they're happening roughly at the same time, we've got what's called temporal summation. They're happening, and we're going to talk about a spatial and temporal window. We can also have spatial summation such that, let's just change the diagram a little bit here, and we'll bring in, let's make another dendritic spine here. And we're going to make this one also positive. So now, let's say we don't even worry about these two. If these two, because they're right beside each other,
You're going to have more positive coming in at the same time. That's spatial summation. Ideally, to make a neuron fire, you're going to want spatial and temporal summation. So they're happening on the order of milliseconds at the same time, and they're also very close to each other. And that is the ugliest diagram I have ever drawn. You know how hard I looked on the internet for a diagram of spatial and temporal summation? I couldn't find one. So, I've got to draw one. Does this make some sense? Yeah, sorry.
So the basic difference between the two is that spatial summation is...
beside each other?
Close. Two dendrites?
Well, it can't be two. It's probably on the order of 3,000. But yeah, close together. The closer together two are, the bigger window in time you have. Right? Okay? The closer together in time two are, the further apart they can be. Spatially. Right? Does that make some sense? Okay. Other questions? So the closer together the stimulation is, and it's the same way, so we got two positives here, the further apart in time they can be. Okay? Yeah, because, well, what I mean by this is, if these happen at, if this one here, this positive over here on the left, and this positive over here on the right, if they happen a few milliseconds apart, pretty good chance, or more of a chance, that the neuron's going to catch up, because it's got to fight over here, fight the sodiums, and fight the sodiums over here. They're never going to get down here to the axon hillock. However, if they're both at the same place, roughly, like these are, they can be a little bit further apart in time. So one after the other. Yep, exactly. Exactly.
Cool.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. And now, again, it's not just sodium and chlorine. We're really tonight only going to talk about sodium ion channels. There are chlorine ion channels, and there are calcium channels, which we might talk about after the break. There are potassium channels. So there are other ones. The most important one typically is the sodium channel, right? But the inhibitory ones are always going to be almost always chlorine because they have to be negative. So this is how you're, this is how this neuron's making a decision to fire, and it could be that, and this is this integration idea, this neuron is making a decision based on what these other four neurons are telling it what to do. And when they tell it what to do, and where they're placed. Which is pretty cool. Yeah, Steph?
So when you throw in neurotransmitters here,
yeah.
So you have GABA.
Yeah,
GABA's going to tell the...
That'd be a GABA. That'd be a GABA synapse right there, yeah.
How does that relate to that chlorine?
Yes. And these could be glutamate, let's say. Exactly.
And how will GABA get in? Oh, it does
do that. That's in this. That's after the break. Yeah, Ron. Yeah, stay tuned. Yeah, Ron.
These turkey fingers, are they action potentials?
No, the action potential would happen if the whole, the negative 70 charge across the membrane, if it collapses.
What are those
then? Those are, these are dendrites. Oh. They're supposed to be dendrites, and these are supposed to be axons.
Oh.
Yeah, please.
So if those sodiums were, say those sodiums on this side
were
chlorine, they come down, then it's not going
to
fire.
It's going to make it less likely to fire, exactly. Yeah, because it's negative, and it's going to make it more negative. Now, it's going to be more negative, let's say it goes from negative 70 to negative 110. The neuron's going to work to get it back to negative 70.
Okay, so it's always trying to...
It's always trying to stay at negative 70. It's only when it gets overwhelmed with sodium that it becomes, that the charge literally collapses and you get a positive charge. Yeah. Good question. Other questions? Yes, please.
Say three neurons hit that one neuron, but they'll release GABA and brought down the negative like 100.
Yeah.
Say then three other neurons shot glutamate at it, like closely in time.
Yes.
One was already at 120.
Yes.
Would it be, because it was so low, yeah, probability of firing is
exactly
a lot lower than if it was at...
Yeah, and that's what an inhibitory postsynaptic potential does. Exactly. Even as bad a diagram as this is, I should probably take a picture of it and put it on the blog, eh? So if you're studying or something...
I have a picture.
Well, yeah, but you don't have it on my blog. When did you get admin rights to my blog, Rob?
You could read my email. My blog.
Well, anybody can read my blog. You have to know the password to get into my... All right. I don't know if the picture's going to help anybody. It'll maybe help you guys. Anybody who's listening in from some other university, you're screwed. You're screwed anyway because you're not going to a cool university like Algoma, yo. That's our new ad campaign. That's just me being a really, really white guy trying to be a rapper. Okay. So the accent here, look, there it is right there, as you can see in full living green and white. That's where the axon starts, and there's a lot of voltage-sensitive channels here. So what's happening here is this thing is really sensitive to voltage, basically. So this is why the vote is taken here. All the way up here, it's just going, no, no, get out, go away, I want to be negative 70. But if it gets to here, and it gets to about, say, negative 50, we get what's called depolarization. And then now suddenly, all the sodium potassium pumps go, okay, that's enough, I give up. I quit. And now, we get positive 50. Positive 55, roughly.
Negative 50 is the sodium pump's breaking point? Then?
Pretty much, yeah, exactly. Negative 50 here. Negative 50 here would be fine. If you can push it out. Right? Yeah, that's right. So, and not all these are called graded potentials. So like here, locally here, this might be negative 90, and this might be negative 40 even. Okay? And I say they're not all graded potentials. Those are called graded potentials, either the excitatory or inhibitory postsynaptic potential. They aren't all created equal. What I mean by that is it might be that we have a lot of ion channels here compared to here. So maybe I got two sodiums coming in everywhere. Maybe here it's actually let in, you know, six because there's more receptors. Okay? So it's not that every single dendrite is exactly the same everywhere. Okay? So they're not all equal. It depends, and again, the space and time thing's important. Okay. Questions about that? It's kind of cool. It's, in fact, kind of incredibly cool. At least to me. Okay. For sensation and for movement, we have receptors for various things. We have receptors for light, and we're going to talk about vision later in June or something. But we do have receptors for light. We have receptors for sound, for smell, taste, touch, pain, all these things. Now, when we get sensation, right, this is what, these things here are in fact what makes a sensory neuron fire. Instead of, and you know this, that it's usually going to be like we have here, which is supposedly some other neuron, so a neurotransmitter. Sensory neurons respond to, say, light, or sound, or smell, or taste, or touch, or pain. The interesting thing is, you can always stimulate a neuron with electricity. You can always stimulate a neuron with pressure. So if I stimulate the neurons in the back of my eye with my finger, by pushing on my eyeball, I actually see something. Right? Right, you see colors. They aren't there, but you see them, because the neurons in the back of your eye, the sensory receptors, are being stimulated, and your brain interprets that as, well, what else could it be? It's got to be a visual stimulus.
You sure they're not there, right?
Yes, I'm exceedingly, completely, and totally sure. Yeah, I'm completely sure. I'm a materialist. I believe in the material, the provable, the testable, the tangible. In the words of Mr. Spock.
So until we can prove its colors, that's damn
right. Oh, they look like color. I'm not saying it doesn't look like color, but it's not color. Color is from light. Is it color? We all heard that, though, right? That was real? Yeah, well, may God strike me down if... Okay. Maybe it was somebody's going to do like a breach and clear kind of deal. I've been playing a lot of Rainbow Six lately. Anyway, so the cool thing is we have receptors that deal with a lot of these other things to internalize the external. And cold and warmth, which is weird. We have cold receptors and warm receptors, not temperature receptors. Sort of weird. So for movement, a neuron synapses onto what's called an end plate, and these have really big ion channels. And think about this. You want your muscles to move as quickly as you can, so it makes a lot of sense that you'd have really big ion channels here, which are these things that let the ions in. And this is done through the neurotransmitter acetylcholine. Yes?
What exactly is an end plate?
An end plate is on a capillary. Okay, so you've got a blood vessel that is on, that is attached to a muscle. Okay, and it's a, to be honest with you, I don't know what it's made out of, but what it looks like is like a plate. It's like a, I've got to think of something that it looks like. You know how you've seen diagrams? The other day we showed the diagram of what it looks like when the myelin is going around a neuron. It's kind of like that. So it's this thing that's wrapped around the capillary, and then it's synapsed right onto there, and then it just goes right into the bloodstream. Yep. Yep. To be honest with you, I don't know what the hell it's made out of. Chocolate. It's made of chocolate. Now, an acetylcholine antagonist, then, remember we talked about agonist and antagonist, that means an acetylcholine antagonist can cause paralysis. So, because acetylcholine makes your muscle contract, so an acetylcholine antagonist can stop you from allowing your muscles to contract, and you'll just stay stiff. You won't be able to move. That's how curare works. You know about curare? It's a poison. If you look back in, say, the Amazon, you ever go, not Amazon.com, I mean like the Amazon, and there's native folks that live there, and the way that they take down animals is they use blow darts and curare, which comes from some plant, I can never remember which, and it's an acetylcholine antagonist. So what they do is they use these blowguns to take down like a monkey. And now the monkey's paralyzed, and they go up to they club it in the head, and then they got dinner. So they don't have to fight with it, right? You can also curare. It used to be used during surgery. Before curare and, you know, vodka. No, I'm serious. You give people brandy, you give them a lot of liquor to kill the pain a bit, and then you keep them still by giving them curare. This would be the way. They don't do surgeries like this anymore. Probably in North Korea they still do or something, but in the rest of the world. An interesting experiment that was done, by the way, John Watson, you know John B. Watson, behaviorist, and he said that thinking is nothing more than micro-speech. Micro-speech. So it's just you moving your mouth a little tiny bit, because Watson, bit nuts. So what he does is he says, I know, I'm going to prove this. I want you to give me some curare, which is going to paralyze me, and I won't be able to think. And he was paralyzed, and he was still able to think, and then he made up some reason why it wasn't true. Good old John Watson. Now, something like sarin, or well, the first nerve gas was tabon, which was invented by the Nazis. Was never used in battle. But sarin is a modern version of tabon gas, which is an acetylcholine antagonist. The difference here is, unlike curare, where you'd need a few cc's of it, here you need micrograms of it to kill you. And you die in an exceedingly unpleasant fashion. It blocks all the acetylcholine receptors. You go rigid, your heart stops, and you die. And you need literally micrograms of it on your skin. And this is why we don't use chemical weapons. Is this, you know, the mustard gas back in World War I? You ever hear about that? Burns your, yeah. This is worse, much worse. Because a little tiny bit of this will kill you. Some was released in a subway, some very poorly made, in Japan about 15 years ago, and it hurt some people, and it killed a couple of people by a crazy cult led by a legally blind guy. I had nothing to do with it. Just saying. So, and acetylcholine is also what makes your heart muscle contract. Yeah, so it's exceedingly unpleasant. So you can use these things for evil, these neurotransmitters. All right. So how are we going to measure this activity in the nervous system? Well, the first thing we could use is the EEG. It's not the oldest form of brain imaging. There is an older technique called the WADA technique, which is what you do is you basically shoot anesthetic into different parts of the spine and then into the brain. To find out basically what stuff did. But it's more of a... It gives you an idea. This is a little less invasive. I know that looks invasive, but you can wear EEGs just on your head. So what's happening in an EEG is it's just measuring electrical activity. You can measure that from the surface of the skin. There's no need to drill any holes or anything like that. This person here has got quite a big one on with hundreds of, looks like, or at least tens of electrodes. You don't need that many. I know that Dr. Townsend in computer science does some brain-computer interface stuff, and he's got a system where I think you put 8 electrodes on, and the idea is to control the display on a computer monitor, brain-computer interface. A friend of mine at the University of Florida, Justin Sanchez, does this really cool stuff where he's doing stuff like this, but for people with, like, paralysis. Amazing stuff. So the idea is now to be able to, through the use of eventually not EEG, they eventually, I think, want to do like a little implant, and then to be able to control a prosthetic so people can walk again. Pretty awesome stuff. But an EEG is actually a pretty simple device. You could build an EEG. You really could. It's not that complicated a piece of gear.
How would you do?
Oh, you'd need electrodes and something to get the readout of the changes in the conductance.
Like the software program?
You could probably do a software. You could do an oscilloscope.
An
oscilloscope? An oscilloscope. Thing that measures oscillations in waves. It's an electrical waves, yeah. Yeah. You could probably make a really crude one with a couple of copper wires and some... What's that stuff called? The gel that they use. It's conductive gel. Yeah. And a little pad, a little metallic pad, and like put it here and here, and then have it hooked up to a voltmeter. Yeah. It would be pretty crude. You wouldn't be able to really measure anything, but you'd see the voltmeter move.
You could measure P500 signals and all that stuff.
Oh, yeah. This is where you get things like P400, you get N400, all these things, yeah. Yeah.
Tell your volume, I know the ECIs run off the main one that's active, they always consistently fire on that, so they could communicate by recognizing some familiar to brain.
That's right.
So, are there any other signals that are useful?
The N300 is another one that people talk about. And it isn't always P300, P500, it depends on the situation. The P300 is the one that's probably had the most research done on.
You should be able to do that with just a simple voltmeter from any
parent. You could. You really could. Yeah. 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 In fact, it's kind of a fun little project to try. I've never done it, but it would be easy enough to do. You couldn't do anything that you could control, Yeah, that's right. You're not going to control the universe with it, but it's a start. CAT scans. Now, CAT scans aren't reading electrical activity, but I thought I'd bring it in here because, frankly, it's another imaging technique. All that this is doing is x-rays from all kinds of different angles to build a 3D, computerized axial tomography, 3D picture. Nice picture. Isn't that a nice picture? That's pretty good. Corpus callosum, right? Cerebellum.
Pons.
Yeah, pons right there. Look at that. Yeah, it's nice. Yeah, it's for holding up your brain. That's what the brain stem does. PET scan's cool, positron emission tomography. What you do here is you drink radioactive glucose. Nothing better. Breakfast of champions. Yeah, well, yeah. Actually, it's just, I mean, it's look, you're not supposed to do it every day. It's like you're not supposed to have an X-ray every day. But you can drink some radioactive glucose. It's not going to kill you. And then the glucose gets taken up into the brain, eh? Because it runs on sugar. And the hotter the color, and the computer does this, it's not like your brain's actually, well, it probably is a little, no, it probably isn't. I don't know. The computer does this, though. Shows where the uptake is. And the hotter the color, the more activity. Right? And you can see here in this diagram, they've got an arrow here pointing here. If you take a look, the rest of this is pretty symmetrical, and there's something, there's no activity on this side of this person's brain. It might mean that something's wrong. But all this is going to do is function, not form. But it is doing it from the chemical, electrochemical process, because to do all this stuff, to do active transport, to do action potentials, you need glucose. So what's happening here is this part of this person's brain is active. Right? Now, an MRI, and especially an fMRI, is the awesome. Functional magnetic resonance imaging. It used to be called nuclear magnetic resonance imaging because it looks at cell nuclei and passes a really strong magnetic field. Okay, but they don't call it that anymore because people didn't like the word nuclear, even though it has nothing to do with radiation at all. It's totally a marketing move. I'm dead serious. It was called nuclear magnetic resonance imaging. And then they said, well, nuclear, it scares me.
It's like nuclear medicine in the basement.
Yeah.
The whole person, they got to go for that, and you just...
Oh, and that's where they do PET scans and things like that, right? And also, you know, even simpler techniques. They usually are giving them radioactive glucose, actually, is what they're doing. So they took the name nuclear, but at least that has something to do with radiation. This doesn't. It has nothing to do with it. So what you're doing here is putting people through a really intense magnetic field, and now you can not only watch form, but you can watch function. So that's now you're getting both. You might ask, why aren't doesn't everybody have these? Because these are more expensive than a CAT scan or a PET scan. But it does do both at the same time. And the cool thing about functional magnetic resonance imaging is with a lag of about 5 seconds, you can watch the changes happen, which is pretty awesome. So this is why, for example, we're starting to be able to get to read the output of the occipital lobe and literally be able to watch what people watch. We're not even close yet, but it's coming. It's coming. It's moving fast. It's moving fast. To hear a little bit about this, by the way, if you're interested, if you look on my blog on the right-hand side, it says Tech Blogs or Tech Podcasts, and one of them is Futures in Biotech, which is a podcast that, in fact, that I'm appearing on this Friday, that I appear on now and then, hosted by a guy named Mark Peltier, who's a crazy, I don't know, I think he's building a race of super animals that are going to take over the world or something. But no, he's not. He's a biotechnology guy. But the cool thing about this is that there's quite a few episodes about MRI on there. My favorite one is one where Mark and I interviewed another guy called, and the episode was called Cogito Ergo Sum by fMRI, where we talked to experts in MRI. There's been a few different brain ones. Whenever there's a brain or psychology one, I'm one of the co-hosts because that's not what Mark does, molecular biology. So,
so why is the F small before the MRI?
I don't know. I've always wondered that myself. Yeah, because it still stands for it's functional. Yeah, I don't understand.
Oh, back to the bus.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, what time are you on the stage, by the way?
3:30 on Friday at twitlive.tv, which is This Week in Tech. It doesn't mean I'm a twit. It's what twits. It's the biggest podcasting network on the interwebs. So I'm on there with three other guys, and we're talking about big science stories that we like this time. I sit in my house. They sit in their labs. I'm at home because my son will be coming home shortly with my daughter. So I've got, and I got a microphone. And you can actually go there. You can actually watch the live video, and we kid around a lot and such. And we talk science. It's pretty cool. Another guy's going to talk about the most recent paper where it turns out that Neanderthal looks like Neanderthals and humans might have actually mated sometimes because there's Neanderthal DNA in ours, it looks like now. I'm talking about a paper about something called the Thatcher effect, which is beyond the scope of what we're talking about tonight, but it's about recognition of inverted faces in monkeys. I just think it's a cool paper. So it's our thing that we do. And it's also a podcast called Futures in Biotech. ERPs are pretty cool, event-related potentials. You can do this with single cells, or you can do it more on a grand scheme like a EEG-type thing. This is actually really pretty cheap to do, and a lot of people will do this in their labs, and it's totally non-invasive. Basically, what you do is you have people do a task, and you see what kind of activity you get. And this is kind of fun stuff. It's interesting. This is a very simple way to do brain imaging. You're not going to use this in a clinical setting. This is really pretty much for research setting. And you can set this up for a few grand and have a nice setup kind of thing.
You consistently use it?
Oh, yeah. And it's the kind of thing that people can use. And it doesn't take a lot of training on how to use it and that kind of stuff, unlike an MRI where you actually need a technician that does the training.
What is an ERP?
Pardon me?
What is an ERP?
ERP, event-related potential. So all you're doing is you're having somebody do something, some event, and you're taking a look at the EEG output, basically. Yeah, it's really quite cool. And it's, like I said, it's very cheap.
What kind of information can you get that's useful?
You could do something like, for example, let's say you have people listen to music. I know this has been done, that's all. And you see, do you get activity in certain places, and is it consistent between, say, musicians and non-musicians? So do musicians and non-musicians perceive music the same way? So that's just an example that just came to mind. Yeah, it's pretty cool stuff. All right, so why don't we, any other questions on this stuff before we take a little break? Yes, please, Ron.
I really didn't understand the difference between a spatial summation and a temporal summation.
Okay, well, spatial summation is when two dendrites, let's say, are roughly are close together. The closer these two are together, the more likely the excitatory, in this case, potential, is going to sum together to cause an action potential. So they're close in space. The other way you get summation is closeness in time. So if this one, and let's pick the other one that's the opposite, are coming, they're not close in space, but they're happening at the same time. Think of it this way. Here's an analogy. Think all those little sodiums. That's water. Think of this neuron as your basement. You've got a leak here and here. If the leak is happening at the same time here and here, your basement is more likely to flood than if it happens at different times here and here. However, if you have two leaks right beside each other, two big cracks in your foundation, even if they don't happen at the exact same time, if they're close by each other, you're probably more likely to get a flooded basement. And the action potential in this case is the flooded basement.
Which is the sodium you shut off with your...
Exactly. You like the flooded basement, Jordan?
Concrete.
Yeah. Yeah. You like the basement? The basement mountain.
Yeah.
Yeah. Other questions? All right. Let's take 10 and come back and talk more about brains, shall we?
Ce soir-là, de 1944, Montréal a défait Détroit 9-1. Maurice Richard marqua 8 points, 5 buts et 3 passes. Une légende est née.
Come on. I believe that it's meant to be, and it is a little like 93. With bathing hands, we hold it high and raise number 25 to the sky. I believe we're right in the mix, and it is a little like 86. With bathing hands, we hold it high and raise number 25 to the sky.
Yeah. Here's a rap from the cradle of organized sports, where we come together for a common cause. I remember number 24, cheers busting out every house, every home. Hard to believe it was so long ago, and I know we got a long, long way to go. I believe this city's got a chance to cop it, so I bust my Camilleri shirt and rock it. Spoke to the ghost of the rocket, told me once the wheels are in motion, can't stop it. Yeah, I thought back to that 10-minute old, when his teardrops pressed the bell centerfold. Put a lot of thought to what I'd rhyme about. How can I wrap my mind around locking number 25 down? There could never be a better time than now.
Yeah. H.R. Van Hall in the plate, even from the short shoulder, is he in? North! H.R. Van!
There could never be a better time than now.
I believe that it's meant to be, and it is a little like 93. With bathing hands, we hold it high and raise number 25 to the sky. I believe we're right in the mix,
Senate, visiting it like 86. With failing hands, we hold it high and raise number 25 to the sky.
Let's party all night for the red, blue, and white, and shine bright like the plasma-marine lights. It's been 100 years, 1909, and in a quarter of that time, we paraded with pride. And if this year we win number 25, you could bet there be a lady celebrating citywide. Yeah, once in a while, I pass by the big O and think since we lost the team, we haven't been exposed. So I climb the tower, raise a glass to the scrolls, and I snatch a torch and pass it to the ghost. I know this 25th crusade won't fail, and we'll be sipping from the holiest of grails. Yeah, sometimes it's by the numbers we're defined. 23, 11, 41, 10, and 9. And maybe number 1 if you're seeing the signs, cause this team I'm feeling and believing 25.
Et c'est la pierre en échec avant, qui vient déranger lui.
Isn't it a light 93? With failing hands, we hold it high and raise number 25 to the sky. I believe we're right in the mix, and it isn't it a light 86? With failing hands, we hold it high and raise number 25 to the sky. I believe that it's meant to be, and it isn't it a light 93? With failing hands, we hold it high and raise number 25 to the sky. I believe we're right in the mix, and it isn't it a light 86? With failing hands, we hold it high and raise number 25 to the sky.
Podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright share like 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.